KSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded February 25th, 2026. Well, Donald Trump's State of the Union address delivered yesterday brought to mind his Republican antecedents' prescience. So too, 20 years ago, 4.5 years into the Afghanistan military occupation, and following nearly 3 years of an insurgent war in Iraq, George W. Bush, evoking predecessors Roosevelt, Truman, Kennedy, and Reagan, declared, "Our own generation is in a long war, a war that will be fought by presidents of both parties and lead this world towards freedom." And he was as good as his word. 20 years and millions killed later, America is still at war for freedom. A freedom shining rainbow-like, leading the nation towards an endless horizon of fear, pain, and despair. Diana Johnstone is an American journalist and author who's lived and worked in Paris for decades. She spent that time chronicling, among other things, America's destructive follies, from the Pentagon's doomsday preparations to its wars of empire. Diana's books include Circle in the Darkness, Memoirs of a World Watcher, Fool's Crusade, Yugoslavia, NATO, and Western Delusion, From Mad to Madness, Inside Pentagon Nuclear War Planning, co-written with her father, Paul H. Johnstone, and now her newly released World Watcher, On Manufacturing War, an anthology of some of her many essays on global affairs. Diana Johnstone in the first half. And this month marks the 6th anniversary of another declaration of war of a sort. On the 4th of February, 2020, Donald Trump's first administration activated the Emergency Use Authorization Act and the PREP Act, precursors to Operation Warp Speed. The COVID-19 response resulting, my second guest says, in, quote, the worldwide forced vaccination of billions of people, millions of whom were injured or killed. That operation was curiously lauded recently by the man who launched it as, quote, one of the greatest military feats ever. Debbie Lerman is a retired medical writer and current investigative researcher. She has focused on all things COVID-related since 2022 independently and with the Brownstone Institute as of 2023. Many of her articles on the topic feature in her book, The Deep State Goes Viral: Pandemic Planning and the COVID Coup. Her recent article, Cheering the Militarization of Everything, Reflections on the 6th Anniversary of When COVID Was Declared a National Security Threat, follows the thread. Debbie Lerman, and From Hiding to Celebrating the Military Corporate COVID Convergence, in the second half. But first, Diana Johnstone and Manufacturing an American Century of War. Welcome back to the show, Diana, and congratulations on the release of your new book.
Well, thank you very much.
Diana, your book is compiled of essays, and they cover a period of 26 years from the war against Yugoslavia to the end of the Biden era's proxy war in Ukraine. Now, America is promising more war against Iran. Diana, a quarter of a century into the 21st century, is war all that America can manufacture?
Well, it looks that way. Plus ça change, plus ça la même chose. It just goes from one war to another, and more blatant than ever. I mean, it used to be that they found pretexts, but it's getting to be that we just say, well, we're strong, and boom, so we can change governments just like that. And it's more and more blatant, and yet people are putting up with it, and that's very hard for me to grasp.
And the resistance to it in this age where you and I are talking to each other across oceans and across continents instantaneously, and yet resistance amongst the populations, it just seems to be Sisyphean, trying to get the attention of those that are pulling the levers of power, especially at the heart of America's empire.
It's perfectly clear that there are certain lobbies behind the members of Congress. As I understood it yesterday, in the speech of this crazy speech of Trump, bragging about how wonderful his rule is, when they spoke about evil Iran and came up with the absolutely extraordinary invention that Iran was making missiles that would strike the United States, all the politicians, even on the Democratic side, stood up and applauded that, which means that the biggest lie you can come up, you can just say anything if about the enemy. Once it's an enemy, you say anything, you invent anything, and the elected members of Congress go along with this, with a few notable honorable exceptions. This is very concerning because there seems to be no real alternative in American politics. You have the famous one-party system, only it's in two parties. There you can't make a third. There's no way to make a third party. There seems to be no way to be original in politics in the United States. It's completely blocked in with two parties that live off huge donations from lobbies. The military industrial complex, which is also a financial capital, and of course, the Israeli lobby, which seems to be totally dictating U.S. policy these days.
Well, donation seems to be a kind word for it. You know, I did sit through, as much as I could handle of the State of the Union last night, and it was advertised to be especially long this time. But I find, when you mentioned Iran, Diana, I find Iran having the missile technology to actually reach the United States a lot less fantastical than Iran being the ones that are training and arming the Mexican drug cartels, which was another charge that Trump made in what seemed to me to be a veiled declaration of intent for American forces to invade its neighbor, Mexico.
I may have missed the worst lies there.
You can be forgiven for that. There was a lot.
Yeah, there's no lie too great to float out there. And of course, all of these things that are said about Iran are completely invented to frighten the American people into thinking this is this terrible enemy. It's just absurd. It's absurd, and yet people go along with it. And this is getting very hard for me to understand. I hope people will look at my book because there are essays on various subjects that... It's a book that, since it's in essay form, it should be easy to read in pieces, right?
About the book, now, it's 37 essays based, as I said, over the last 26 years or so, published originally at Counterpunch and at consortiumnews.com, where you've been for the last number of years. When we talk, Diana...
Not only. There are some from a few other places.
Well, this is what I'm curious about, because when we compare, we've seen the lockdown of communications, internet communications on various platforms have been radically censored. We see... the involvement of various tech bros and their backers in Israel, primarily shutting things down. But it was never really easy to tell the kind of stories that you tell and that are chronicled in your book. I mean, it's always been difficult to go against the wisdom of the accepted wisdom of the day, especially when it comes to the kind of top topics that you cover, war and political expansionism.
Oh yes, it certainly has, and of course I ran into it, especially in the question of the wars in Yugoslavia, because that's where I ran into a great deal of resistance, criticism, censorship, just plain people, you know, not publishing my articles. I had to go to Covered Action for that for a while. And of course, I was right, but people still don't know it. I have several articles on Yugoslavia because I think it was very crucial. It was the beginning of a series of post-Cold War wars, which transformed NATO into this totally aggressive force. And it was sold to the public as a humanitarian war when we bombed Yugoslavia, which again was... That is where I encountered really the first time directly the lies from what I knew firsthand. And of course, it's just gone on and on and on. But Yugoslavia is important to me because mm-hmm. it is the myth of the good war when it was the beginning of the bad wars.
Well, this is, Diana, where I came in with Guerrilla Radio in 1998, was covering Yugoslavia. And we didn't really have the internet as people recognize it today in those ancient days. And yes, pterodactyls ruled the skies. But I just had a sense that what we were being told was baloney. It just stank right from the beginning.
It's a very good sense you had.
Was really difficult on both sides of the political spectrum. If we'll just assume that for a second, it was the left side of the political spectrum under the Clinton regime that was in power at the time, and all the left liberal types were supporting this. They were all saying Milosevic was Satan or Hitler reincarnate or something. You know, these kind of lies that we're really used to now. But back then, this was kind of a new template of massaging propaganda into the public context that we weren't really ready for, at least I sure wasn't, and weren't really armed to defend ourselves against. Now, of course, its repetition has worn it out somewhat. What kind of resistance did you come up against when you were trying to tell the story?
Well, for instance, I had been European correspondent for the Social Democratic newspaper in these times. They refused my articles when I was in Kosovo and had been there before in my life. This was not the first time I'd been there. I knew the country. I spoke a little bit of the language. The Nation, which had been wanting my articles and asked for my articles, would not publish me. That's why I ended up writing for Covered Action, because neither In These Times nor The Nation, which are left-wing publications, dared go against the dominant theme, which is that we have to save these people from the bad guys, you know. That was the idea. It was the human rights propaganda, and of course the war there, people were killing each other. I mean, on all sides is not very nice. But it was certainly, you know, to call a country that's falling apart analogous to Hitler invading all of Europe is pretty far fetched. But that's what they were doing.
I remember it as the beginning of the R2P, the responsibility to protect doctrine.
Exactly.
But the responsibility to protect has been invoked time and time again. And what we see is it's the destruction of one country after the next, wherever this thing comes in. What threat did Yugoslavia pose to NATO back then? Why was it so imperative that to them that it be broken up and destroyed in the manner that it was?
Well, I think there were different actors in that. To start with, there was Germany, which had been just being reunited, and once it was reunited, began to move away from the peace policy that had distinguished it when it was trying to be reunited. And there was a revenge on the part of the Germans against Serbia, which is his historic adversary, and trying to get back influence that it had over Croatia and Slovenia, which had been part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. But then the U.S. moved in, and with the U.S., it takes on a bigger scope, because I first of all, you have to realize that Yugoslavia was an independent socialist country. It was not part of the Soviet bloc. It had a mixed economy. And after the fall of the Soviet Union, although the joke is that a lot of leftists, a lot of anti-Soviet leftists would say, oh, if only the Soviet Union is gone, then socialism will have a better reputation and it will spread over the world. It's quite the opposite. The collapse of the Soviet Union meant that there was no need on the West to sort of balance out the social benefits of the communist regime, and they could go whole hog in neoliberalism. And so the problem with Yugoslavia was both that it had a socialist system, but perhaps just as much that it was part of the non-aligned alliance. It was aligned with third world countries. They had protested against the murder of Lumumba. They were aligned with third world liberation struggles. And I think those two things were motive enough to get rid of Yugoslavia. But of course, they manipulated ethnic conflicts, which are real. There is historic basis for that. And you go into a place like that with agents, and it's easy to arouse historic animosities and take advantage of them and work them up. And so this was used. And then, of course, they didn't say it was just the ethnic conflict. They say, oh, no, it's one of the countries, it's Serbia, that is trying to be awful to the other one. So they didn't just see conflict. They decided for one was the bad guy and all the others were the good guys. And so they made this moralistic theme out of it, that they had to rescue everybody else from the Serbs. And the Serbs actually probably suffered more than anybody else from that, because the Serbian population in Croatia was expelled more than anybody else. And then the final thing is that there was no more reason for NATO to exist, because the Soviet Union had collapsed. There was no... And so this was a way of finding a new mission for NATO. This was the way that they revived NATO as a new humanitarian force that could go off. It had been a defensive force for Europe, but now it became a force that could go anywhere on the grounds of, as you say, the responsibility to protect human rights, anywhere on this humanitarian mission. And this propaganda aimed at winning over support from the left, and it did.
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Diana Johnstone. Diana is an American journalist and author. She's lived and worked in Paris for many, many years, spent most of that time chronicling the destruction, the follies of the Pentagon and America all over the world. Her books include Circle in the Darkness, Memoirs of a World Watcher, Fool's Crusade, Yugoslavia, NATO, and Western Delusions, From Mad to Madness, Inside Pentagon Nuclear War Planning, that with her father, Paul H. Johnstone. And now her newly released book is the anthology of her many, many essays, or some of them at least, World Watcher on Manufacturing War. Yeah, and Diana, also, Yugoslavia had managed under Tito and to straddle those two competing powers of Russia and the West. They had a socialist system, but they weren't controlled by Russia. They didn't have the totalitarian tinge that you would see in Eastern Germany or some of the Eastern European countries within the Warsaw Pact or the Soviet orbit. Before that, they seem to actually be an example of socialism getting it right. Or am I looking through rosy glasses at the past?
Nothing is perfect by any means. But certainly, I mean, I had numerous intellectual friends in Yugoslavia. And as Yugoslavs, they were free to travel. I mean, Sveta Stojanovic, who was probably the closest of my friends, I mean, he went and gave lectures or taught in Germany or the United States. They were absolutely free. In fact, they say the Yugoslav passport was the best in the world because it was welcome everywhere. And, of course, there are limits on freedom, but there are limits on freedom everywhere if you stop to look at it. Yugoslavia was independent, but the problem was that that because it was not in the Soviet bloc, it had taken out loans from Western powers. And when the debt crisis came, this is really what broke up Yugoslavia, because what happened is that Yugoslavia got into some bad debts with the Western powers. This led to the conflicts between the republics within Yugoslavia, because each one wanted the other to pay. And in particular, Slovenia and Croatia, as the richest of them, didn't want to have to pay for Kosovo and Macedonia, which are poorer. And so it began a political strife because of debt, of all things. So that was a very non-socialist element which came in and undermined socialist Yugoslavia.
Your book covers so much ground, and I don't want to bog down just on Yugoslavia, but just briefly before we go, I mean, there's two elements of it that I just find really important in our modern world, too. One was the Srebrenica massacre.
Srebrenica.
Thank you. It's been so long, I've forgotten how to pronounce it.
Yeah.
And you have a chapter or an entry in there, Srebrenica Revisited. What is it? What is Srebrenica, and why does it need revisiting?
Because what happened has never been absolutely clearly proven. It started out almost from the beginning. The Western powers were accusing the Serbs of genocide. So when the Srebrenica fell, and there something happened, some bad things happened. Then this was the genocide they'd all been looking for, and the extent of massacres is not clear. By the way, it was never clarified. The figures are uncertain and have been deliberately exaggerated because it's very clear if you have people fighting on both sides. For instance, you had jihad Muslims that came in and fought on the Bosnian side and committed a few massacres of their own. You don't hear about that. So some bad things were happening all over, but you just attribute them all to one side and then exaggerate them. And then that became this supposed genocide in Bosnia became the pretext for the war in Kosovo by saying, oh, the Serbs, and of course, it was not the Bosnian Serbs, it was the Bosnian Serbs, not the Serbian Serbs who were fighting in Bosnia, by the way. But they said the Serbs committed genocide in Srebrenica, they'll do it in Kosovo. So it became this genocide thing. For one thing, it decides you label one side as genocidal, then the other side is perfectly virtuous, you see. This is a dichotomy. This is a dualism, absolute dualism, the genocides versus the victims, where, in fact, people were killing each other on all sides, unfortunately. Then it becomes the excuse for further wars. This was used totally fake. Threat of genocide in Libya was used to destroy Libya.
Kosovo became a landing base for NATO expansionism. They built Camp Bondsteel, this infrastructure that exists still today. They created a country they carved out and created Kosovo out of whole cloth, where it still is today. But at the time, it was known for its corruption, the mafia that was running it, extreme violence, and all of the ills that we see in places like maybe Kiev today.
It's not exactly like Kiev. Kiev is very corrupt, but it's a more sophisticated kind of corruption. Kosovo was more gangsterism of the mafia style. It's a kind of society that goes by personal honor and so on and so on. They never liked a legal state. I mean, some people did, but the ones who were fighting against the Yugoslavs were gangsters. I mean, they were engaging in various traffics. I guess the most shocking one is the traffic of human organs, but it was usually much more things like liquor or just, I don't know, whatever. But they've shown up all over Europe, the Kosovo mafia. These rebels in Kosovo were really gangsters who didn't like the legal order. It's as simple as that.
Well, I've always thought of Yugoslavia, and we've spent almost all of our time on this, and I apologize because the book is so much broader than this. Again, it's World Watcher on Manufacturing War by Diana Johnstone, available through Clarity Press right now, just freshly out. But I've always thought that it all sort of began in Yugoslavia. Everything that followed over these last terrible quarter century and more of one war after another, started by NATO and its Western allies, Canada included. You mentioned Libya being destroyed, but it just seems like the seminal moment to me.
I was planning to talk about Europe, and what I was planning to talk about Europe is that they have taken on hatred of Russia as their raison d'être, and it's terrifying. It's ridiculous. It's completely unnecessary, and it's like, as a European, you can't care about your own country anymore, because that would be nationalism. You have to be European. And to be European, then if you're European, you're against Russia. And I think this is absolutely insane.
But why Russia, the Western Russia at least, is very European and has a long history with Europe. What's the source of this animus? I've always wondered. This European animus. I understand the Brits, you know, have their own thing going, but what is it about Russia?
The Brits are a big part of it. They've been going on since the 19th century with Russia as the enemy. You know, the Great Game in Central Asia, the Crimean War, which was against Russia, and then there are the little countries, the Baltic states and Poland, who just have a historic hatred of Russia. And by bringing them into the European Union, it's given them a huge role, you know. I mean, it's one of the insane features now is that the foreign policy spokesperson for the European Union is this Estonian woman, Kaja Kallas, whose only qualification is a blind hatred of Russia. Although during communism, her father was a prominent banker in communist Estonia, they didn't suffer. But she talks about them suffering under blah, blah, blah. It's not even true. It's somehow the hatred of the little one to the big one next door. Whereas in the South, I mean, the Italians have nothing against Russia. The Spaniards have nothing against Russia. It's really this Northern. And, of course, with Germany is very divided right now, because there are people on both sides of this. But the ones in charge are looking for revenge against Russia, and that's very dangerous.
Diana, thanks a lot for coming on again, and good luck with the book, eh?
Well, thank you very much. And I agree with you so much about Yugoslavia being the start of things, but unfortunately, it's very far from over.
Yeah, it goes on and on. I'm going to take a break. When I come back, I'm going to be joined by Debbie Lerman down there in the States. We're going to talk about war in another form, the war after COVID. Thanks again, Diana.
Thank you.
Moscow, Tokyo, New York. Guerrilla Radio is everywhere. Everywhere, all the time.
Chicago. Jakarta. Helsinki. Cape Town. Sao Paulo. Manchester. Bangalore. And somewhere in Russia, I can't actually remember the name.
It's terrifying times with masked police occupying American city streets, raiding homes and detaining anyone who might be remaining, separating children from mom and dad, the only family the kids had, sending them to another state, trying so hard to make us great.
In response, the people say, you won't be alone, as long as we have a whistle.
Call
incredible brutality. There may be thousands.